Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to tonight's episode of A Time for Justice. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad and I am the host of this show. This show, A Time for Justice, is on the Elevated Places Network and we are so excited that you're joining us once again. On this show, A Time for Justice, we discuss legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failures to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts that these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight, and we have some really, really excellent attorneys tonight. All of our attorneys are excellent, but, you know, every time we're blessed to have people take time out of their schedules, the believers, the attorneys who are believers to join us, is such a blessing. So as I was saying, tonight our guests will not make those excuses for racist conduct, you know, which really are distractions, because this is what we often see, but they're distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are really in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. And so again tonight, we are going to be talking about the denial of constitutional rights to Blacks in America. We're going to put some special emphasis on the unfair treatment and injustice. As I said, tonight our guests are really, really fabulous guests. Let me go ahead and open up the show by bringing on the guests, and then I want to give an excerpt from the final call. I want to go ahead and bring up one of our favorite attorneys, Brother Warren Muhammad. Brother Warren has been a practicing attorney since 1979. He has maintained an extensive practice in the field of entertainment. He also, though, he practices personal injury, wrongful death, medical mal, civil litigation. I know Brother Warren has done criminal law as well, and, you know, just some of really everything, jury trials. We also want to note that Brother Attorney Warren was also appointed as an associate judge in the municipal court by the mayor in 2012. So he did represent that position, and I think he was actually reappointed for a second term. So again, Brother Warren has a private practice of law, the Law Office of Warren Fitzgerald. I believe his firm is actually known as WFM. And also, I can't not mention that he's also a head of a community association here in his home area of Acres Home. So let me go ahead and open up Brother Warren's mic. Brother Warren.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Brother Warren. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you, sir?
Are you most welcome, Sister Pamela? I'm doing well by Allah's grace. And just one praise correction on your introduction, it's the law firm of Warren Fitzgerald Muhammad, PLLC.
Sir, and so thank you so much for correcting me on that. And yes, sir. So I'll go on
I'm
to
really
the
happy
next.
To be here.
Yes, sir. And we are so happy to have you, Brother Warren. You had a comment from last week, and that comment landed you on this panel. And we really want you to express some of your some of your opinions and perceptions. And so let's go ahead and bring on. We're so blessed to have returning with us Judge Nichelle Muhammad. And as you all know, Judge Nichelle Muhammad is actually a sitting judge in the city of Mount Vernon, New York. Our sister, Sister Judge Nichelle, has been a judge since April of 2016 in the Mount Vernon City Court. She's the first Muslim and Latino judge in the city of Mount Vernon. Sister Nichelle, Judge Nichelle, was a practicing attorney for more than 20 years, which included areas such as municipal defense, family, criminal matters, matrimonial. Sister Nichelle is married. Her husband is Brother Arthur, and she has four daughters. And let's see what else. We know that Sister Nichelle attended Brooklyn Law School. And so I'm going to bring on Sister Nichelle because she was with us last week and she's returning. And so I just am so excited that she's taken out her precious time as a judge and a believer to come on and join us on A Time for Justice. Sister Nichelle.
All praises be to Allah. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Sister Pamela. What a beautiful introduction. All praises due to Allah, Sister. It's never an imposition for me to come and share with my nation and the believers who I love dearly. So all praises due to Allah. I thank you. And to my brother Warren, who I know, and Sister Sadia, I'm happy to share the rostrum, if you will, with both of them today. And I don't find it to be an imposition at all. And I love being here and sharing what I can. All praises due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Praises be to Allah. Thank you so much, Sister Judge Nichelle, for that. And with that, let me go ahead and open up the mic of our attorney, Sadia Kareem. Now, Sister Sadia's byline on her curriculum vitae says that she's a servant, she's a wife, she's a mother, she's a sister attorney, she's a freedom fighter, author, and professional speaker. And for many of us who know Sister Sadia, we know her we've seen her in many of those roles for sure. Sister Sadia has been a member of the Texas Bar since April 2002. She graduated from Texas A&M undergrad, receiving her JD from Thurgood Marshall School of Law right here at the Texas Southern University Law School. Sister Sadia has, before becoming an attorney, she notes that she worked in politics and social activism, working for some very, big politicians, such as some work for Bill Clinton, Carole Robinson. She actually opened her own law office in 2004. And she specializes in litigation, misdemeanors, felonies, and that's on the state and federal level. And like I say, she's known in her legal community as the godly warrior lawyer, being an activist and freedom fighter since the age of 15. Sister Sadia has a non-for-profit by the name of Queendom Come. She works on various boards such as Action CDC, and she's a registered member of the nation. And Sister Sadia, she wants us to know that she is a devoted wife to Brother Kasala Kareem and a proud mother of seven children. Okay? She's a proud mother of seven children. So that's really beautiful, beautiful sister. Sister Sadia, assalamu alaikum.
Well, alaikum salam, ma'am. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here with the powerhouse lawyers. You, of course,
yes,
being one of those
all
lawyers who I see as a freedom fighter.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. All praises are due to Allah. And thank you once again. So our topic tonight is, again, the denial of constitutional rights to blacks in America, unfair treatment, and injustice. And we're going to start this conversation by noting, we're staying on this topic of injustice because, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan noted in the December 21st edition of The Final Call in an article called Why We Are Calling You to Boycott Christmas. You know, he talked about how we've got to stay on the subject of justice. And it's quoted in this article as saying the loss of economic strength, you know, will cause the doors to open. He went on to, at the end of the article, use and quote some of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King in his April 3rd, 1968 speech, "I've been to the mountaintop." And those words are, you know, go by the businesses, the stores, and tell them God sent me by here to say to you, you are not treating his people fair. That should be the first agenda. The minister goes on to say, these are Dr. King's words. God said he wants you to treat his people fair. That should be first on your agenda. And so kind of want to open up with that, because the question is, as we talk about, you know, why we're boycotting, why the minister called for a boycott, we're in that season, you know, but the question is, are black people being treated fair? You know, in light of all this madness going on, the violations of constitutional rights, and, you know, with the shot, the vaccine, they're trying to force that on us. That's a violation of our rights. We know the murders. We know, you know, all of the police brutality, just a real denial of rights. And we wanted to take it all the way back. So I want to go ahead and open up the mic, because when I say all the way back, I'm saying all the way back to slavery. Whereas Brother Abdul Rahman said, you know, slavery really, we can trace these injustices, the drive-by shootings, the drugs, the gangs, all of it can be traced back to slavery. So, you know, I wanted to open up the mic and start with our conversation on the historical framework that has led us as black people here in America, the context. And would we say that are God's people being treated fairly? Any opening remarks regarding that, please share.
Sister Pam?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Brother Warren.
Yes, ma'am. I would like to open by taking us all the way back to the uniqueness of our experience here in our sojourn in America. From its historical framework, and we can go all the way back to Scripture, both in the Bible and in the Holy Quran, because in Genesis in 15:13, God makes, well, he takes Abraham into a vision or a dream, and he shows him where he says, your children will serve in a land that is not their own and be slaves. Or be servants, or in some translations they actually say be slaves and be oppressed for 400 years. And at that time I will come and bring them out with great substance and wealth or great possessions. So we see from our actual history that there is no people who fits that prophecy better than we, the black man and woman here in America, who were in fact brought and put into slavery in a land not our own, and we have been here 400 years. And then also, even in the Holy Quran, in Surah 2, 127 through 129, where Abraham and Ishmael raised the foundation of the Kaaba, and they prayed to Allah to make us both submissive to thee, and from our offspring raise a nation submissive to thee. And then it says further, to raise up in them a messenger from among them who will recite to them thy messages and teach them the book and the wisdom and purify them. And this is precisely what has happened here in America, is that God has raised a nation of submission, which by definition means a nation of Islam, and raised among us a messenger of our own for us. So we start all the way back to the beginning in Scripture of Genesis and in the Holy Quran to show how unique we are in our historical framework.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. Anybody else who's next?
This is Sister Sadia. So,
yes, ma'am.
Dovetailing on what Brother Warren, who excellently laid the foundation of this conversation from a biblical and a Quranic experience of black people, knowing that this was prophesied and that we fit that particular people, then to the answer to your question, Sister Pam, yes, it had to be, this had to be fulfilled. And this was the way that it had to be fulfilled. And so when you look at the structure and how the United States was formed, you know, of course, black people were never considered property. I mean, never considered as human beings, but we were always considered property or considered to be chattel. And when the states began to fight each other and abolish slavery, you know, the idea and the thought of white supremacy prevailed, turning it into slave codes, black laws, to continue to make black people subservient. You bring it up to, you know, modern time, and we all we have to do is watch the news and read the statistics of the black and the browns versus the whites and how we are treated, and we are just following in the prophecy. But we know that a man came 9,000 miles on by himself from the east to save a lost people. And so we thank Allah for that. But history is unfolding. Minister Farrakhan talked about the unraveling of a nation, and his words are right and exact, and probably still manifesting itself. So we thank Allah that the bottom rail will be the top rail, and that we will no longer, regardless of what white supremacy or the white forefathers had set up for black people in America, that we know that we will be the rulers. But the thing is, we have to separate from this society.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. Sister Nichelle, did you want to add anything?
Yes, ma'am. Of course. And in dovetailing off of what Sister Padilla just said, she brought up, you know, the history of this country vis-a-vis colonialism, slavery, Jim Crow, in other past structural inequalities. We know that what we're experiencing now, police brutality, racial profiling, and racial disparities, all stems from that tree from years ago. And if we remember that Jim Crow laws kind of like represented the legitimization of anti-black racism, where many Christian ministers and theologians taught that whites were the chosen, blacks were cursed to be servants, and that God supported racial segregation. And that allowed these Jim Crow laws to affect us, okay? And it was undergirded by these beliefs and rationalization that whites were superior to blacks in all important ways. One of the movies that I thought that came out that did a great job of dealing with this particular type of activity was Birth of a Nation, that was done by our beloved brother. I forget the brother actor's name, but in there, they were talking about how the whites use the Bible to make the slaves believe that they were servants and were slaves and were to submit to the power of these white people. And it was during that movie, Nat Turner figured out that what he was doing by being the Bible pusher, if you will, going to different slave places and preaching to the slaves that we have to submit, he started to realize that there was something wrong with this teaching. And there led the revolt, if you will, of Nat Turner and those brave souls back then. But the bottom line is, as Sister Sadia said, and Brother Warren too, it goes back. And if we just take it to America, we go to the colonialism, Jim Crow, and the stuff that happened there. And it leads all the way up to where we are today, having not been satisfied or taken care of, in that we are now suffering with institutional and systematic racism that sprung from there. And God willing, as Sister Sadia and Brother Warren said, yes, we are the chosen people spoken of as we are taught. And it's clear that nobody meets the criteria, if you will, or the explanation of who these people would be, but the black man and black woman of North America. And so we are so happy to have a teaching this day that teaches us who we are in the scriptures and doesn't miseducate us the way the whites did to the slaves in making us think that we were something other than God's children. All praises due to Allah.
Oh, yes, ma'am. That is beautiful, beautiful, because as I'm listening to you all, see, y'all are smart, right? We, all the Muslims, lawyers, and we're so blessed to have the teachings of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad through him. And, you know, the thing is that a lot of our people who don't, may not be as familiar, they say, well, does that apply to today? You know, how does that look in today's court? Because we're often taught that slavery ended, these amendments, these laws have made us whole, and is there really a correlation? So let's kind of dig into that. Why do we think there is a correlation? Because we had these amendments, 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment. What are the correlations that we see today in some of these court systems? And I promised that we would start with a article out of the Final Call called Mississippi Injustice, and that was the December 21st edition as well. And in that article, you see a sister by the name of Tamika Drummer. And again, this article was written by our beloved sister Anissa Muhammad. She's just a wonderful writer. And sister Tamika Drummer is a black woman in the state of Mississippi who was sentenced to prison at the age of 34. She's 47 now. But the key is that she's been there for 17 years. And she was actually sentenced because of actually possessing less than 2 ounces of marijuana. And we would say, you know, how does that happen? But, you know, as you all may have read, you know, she was a habitual offender, I think it was. And so these are those type of laws. So does that correlate to the 13th Amendment or any of this failure, this promise? As Brother Warren say, you know, we're in the land, we slaves, you know, we've been purified, that's for sure. So do we see any scriptural or any from our day-to-day practices that we'd like to discuss regarding that case? You know, I like my questions were, you know, what is the impact of the failure to enforce the 13th Amendment when you look at these type of cases? There was a quote in the article where the minister, I think he talked about just the community itself. A lot of times our communities, where there's incarceration, vaccination, poor education, poor job, poor storage with food quality, things of that nature. And he said it's all designed. And we know from some constitutional perspectives, is this really slavery? And so I just kind of wanted to give the listeners any impact on your experience with unjust sentencing, this Clinton, you know, three strikes, you're out. I know, Brother Warren, you probably were practicing during that time. And have you seen any impact with some of the cases where people got these type of unjust sentences? They've been in, you know, she got for 2 ounces of marijuana, less than 2 ounces of marijuana. She's got life without parole. Anybody have any experience with that?
Okay, Sister Pamela, if I may, I would like to,
yes, sir,
kind of go into create maybe a backdrop to all of,
okay,
these cases, and then maybe we can come forward to deal with some of the specific cases. But when you mention first,
yes, sir,
first, we have to understand when we start to talk about our constitutional rights.
Okay.
That the Constitution of the United States of America was, in its fabric, a slave document. It was based on slavery. So in the Bill of Rights, it says that the Fifth Amendment guarantees no person could be deprived of life, liberty, or property. And we were commonly understood, and defined as property. So it was telling the slaveholding states that no one could deprive them of their slaves without due process of law. It was built right into the Constitution. And it says in Article 2, where it talks about a person held to service or labor in one state under the laws escaping to another. That was the Fugitive Slave Act. So that brings us up to the 13th Amendment. I would submit that America is actually enforcing the 13th Amendment, because
okay,
it says that involuntary servitude well, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist except as punishment for a crime. And that's the key part, is except as punishment for a crime. So they have erected the criminal justice system. All of these laws, going back to the vagrancy laws and just every kind of law they've come up with to find a way to incarcerate us and convict us and then enslave us through the 13th Amendment, because it allows slavery when it's punishment for a crime. So
yes, sir.
It's kind
yes,
of a different
sir.
Way of looking at it. But in that sense, what they gave in the big print, they took away in the small print. So they outlawed slavery in the big print, and then they put it back in place through the criminal justice system in the second half of that amendment. So I'll stop there and like to hear from some of the other panelists.
I would just like to ask, Sister Pam, so when you look at the whole institution of slavery, it was big business. And so
yes,
when
ma'am.
You have these slave masters who had to stop producing, had to shut down shop, they had to figure out another way to get their employees back on the plantation. And so they created the 13th Amendment. Now you have involuntary servitude for crimes that were committed. And we see black people with these trumped up charges. Now they're incarcerated. And now we have the advent of the prison industrial complex. And if you look at the prison industrial complex right now, we know that major corporations, that their major employees come from the prison industrial complex, from McDonald's to Walmart to Target. I mean, I could keep going on and on and on about Fortune 500 companies who benefit off of slave prison labor. And so, again, the whole idea of slavery was based on economics. So now we're in the Christmas season, and we're dealing with freedom, justice, and equality, or justice or else, and we're dealing with economics. And so when we boycott economics, that sends a great message to the system that was set up to enslave us. You saw during the uprisings with George Floyd. Most of these corporations, they didn't really care about what really happened. They cared about their bottom line. So you started seeing corporations with their PR talking about they're for Black Lives Matter, because they know that we as black people make up at least $16 trillion of the economy, which is a whole nation by itself.
Wow. That's right, Teach. Yes, ma'am.
That's
yes,
right.
Ma'am. Sister Michelle, did you want to put anything on the table with this particular round?
Yes, ma'am. Very quickly, as Brother Warren and Sister Sadia said, absolutely. We talked about this last week, that 13th Amendment, although it said it freed and did all these things, we had the jail system that came out of it, right, where people were put in jail, and now people were put in jail, and there was still the slavery in jail, where they're making money for the jail system, et cetera. And we saw recently where there were judges. I mean, I know here in New York State, I believe it was here in my state, that there were judges literally on the pay for some of these institutions to put these young black people in jail as a source of economics. You know, the jails had to fill a certain amount of bodies on the beds. And so this judge was being paid to send these people to these institutions. So it goes to show you that, you know, and of course they were young black men and women. And so it goes to show you that absolutely the 13th Amendment came in. We got out of slavery, but were we really out of it? Because now we're imprisoned and we're doing slave jobs there. And then you have these mandatory minimums, right? And so when you look at the structure of what even Ms. Drummer was under, you know, in Mississippi, and New York had some very similar laws, but they did away with
right.
them. But I could see Mississippi still has not done that. But what happens is when you look at a repeat offender and you put in a recidivist in jail and, you know, three strikes, you're out and stuff like that, that goes to mostly our people. Because from the time that we're young and basically forced into criminal activity by virtue of the way that we live and or we don't live, you know what I mean? Then it's very easy to target someone and say, okay, if you have, you know, these three strikes, now you're out. Now you go in, which is what Ms. Drummer is experiencing. But yet the Mississippi folks have not done a good enough job of fighting against these mandatory minimums. It is, as Sister Brother Warren and Sister Sadia said, a continuation of this economic thing also. Just like slavery, Sister Sadia said, was economics, so too is this jail sentencing and stuff like that, and what Ms. Drummer is experiencing for something so little as marijuana.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and like you said, I think just looking at, for me, the fact of the matter is that the time frame from the you know, the abolition of slavery, the emancipation to 1877 when they removed the federal troops, and that little period of Reconstruction, we know that that wasn't really a very long period of time. That was only about 14 years. So when we were, when slavery was ended and after we had been robbed and you know, just totally they built a whole world off of our labor, you know, the 13th Amendment looked to the fact that black people were like a childlike people. This is what some of the legal jargon. So this whole thing about telling us how to think, what to think, this whole thing about private corporations that are controlling our communities, even when we're living in these neighborhoods, do we really own anything, as Sister Sadia was saying? So I think, do we think that that also has an impact on the conditions that our people are in and that we were in, but for these teachings, you know, that have actually given us a wake-up call as to how to dig our way out of this involuntary servitude, peonage, right, convict leasing.
Come on now. If I could jump in really quickly, Sister Pamela, Sister Michelle again, you know, we have this saying that we say, if they don't treat you right, then they don't teach you right. And so what happens is, we have accepted the teachings of this white man ever since slavery, and they were teaching us things, and it's become a program in our mind. And it's hard for us to come off of that. And, you know, this was why the work, I think they said the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad had the toughest job trying to civilize and get to our people, because we are tough people to get to. But a lot of that is because we were taught the wrong stuff. And so we thank God for a teaching that came to elevate us and open our eyes, ears, and our hearts into a different teaching. That, yeah, Jesus wasn't this white man that our grandparents had on the wall and, you know, all of these other things about how great we were. We didn't just start out as savages running through a jungle, which is what I was taught when I was a little girl. That's where our history started. And I can't tell you what it does to the mind of a child to be taught that in a school system where they say that your history started when we found you in some jungles running around naked and like savages around there, and what that does to the psyche. So we're coming through a system where we were not taught correctly, and we thought Jesus was white, and we thought the white man was this, and we were just savages. We were running. And so it took a mighty teacher to come, and we thank Allah, Master Fahd Muhammad in person, who came 9,000 miles to raise a man, to teach him really who we were and who we are and why it's so important. So I'm clear that the teachings that we have gotten are so ingrained that it's so hard for us to come out of it. And we are coming out of it by the grace of Allah because of the teaching that we had vis-a-vis Master Fahd Muhammad, who came and raised the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad to this teaching and taking apart these books, the Bible and the Quran, and showing us where we fit into it. So I think we are doing what we can. We have a lot more work to do, but I'm clear that the thinking of our people, we are this way because we were taught this way for so many years. And so it's hard to deprogram, but I think the deprogramming is starting. The bones are starting to rustle and listen to the preaching onto the bones coming out. And so I'm happy for that. All praise is due to Allah.
Praise due to Allah. Look, Sister Michelle, Judge Michelle, look, I was right in your head, because as soon as Sister Pamela said the teachings, it was the teachings, it was a new education that we were given. Honorable Elijah Muhammad
That's right.
says, he who gives you the diameter of your knowledge prescribes the circumference of your activity. And so that's why during slavery they did not want us to read. They did not want us to really understand our culture and where we came from and the higher maths. Because once we had an education, then we were going to be able to do for self. But the thing is, you know, we have to divorce. We have to get away from this world's education. We have this world's system of education and create a new paradigm that we've done in the Nation of Islam. But we know that we're dealing with the whole of humanity, and we have to be able to disconnect from it all, our brothers and sisters from all over the planet. Now, as far as, you know, just taking it personal in court, you know, most of the, when I'm in court and representing my clients, the biggest thing for me is that most of my clients that I'm representing come from a history or a background where education was really not considered or was really not that important. And so because our people can't really think for themselves, then other people can plant ideas and thoughts into their minds. And, you know, like the 85% that we talk about in our supreme wisdom, they're, you know, easy to lead astray and hard to get them to do right. But as we, as the civilized people, we have a duty to teach and train, to civilize, to give them wisdom, knowledge, understanding, refinement, and culture. And then we have the duty and the obligation, because there's a severe penalty if we don't. So, you know, that's why I got into the business
that
I'm in, to help the minds and to elevate the minds of the people, whether it's through law or whether it's through advocating through spirituality.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. Go ahead, Brother Barnes.
I'd like to dive right in on that, because we've been talking about the 13th and the 14th Amendment. And that was something that was said last week, and it made me think about something that I had written in the book that I put out a couple of years ago called The Case for Separation.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Allah had allowed me to speak concerning the 14th Amendment. I made the comment that we have to be careful about the political leadership telling us what's good for us and who we are and what we are.
Yes,
to actually read these words for ourselves and glean the meaning of them. Because the 14th Amendment, I made the comment in the book that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution made us lawful captives.
Okay.
So we might say, so what is a lawful captive? Well, in the dictionary it says a captive is a prisoner of war. Well, where is the war? The war started back in 1452 when the Pope of the Catholic Church issued the edict, the Dum Diversus, said he granted to all of Europe the full and free power and apostolic authority to invade, conquer, fight, subjugate the Saracens, the Muslims, and all pagans and other infidels and enemies of Christ wherever established, and to go forth, capture, dominate, kill, take their goods, take their property, take their women, and take their land. This was an edict by the Pope. And everything that transpired after that was on the basis of this edict. When Columbus sailed, he sailed on the basis of this edict by the Pope. So when he landed and started taking land, killing people, taking their women, he was doing what the Pope had authorized. So the Pope had issued a declaration of war on the Muslim and the world of color, which made us, when we were then brought here in Isaiah, in the Bible, it says, shall the prey be taken from the mighty, or the lawful captive be delivered? So what's a lawful captive? He's lawful under the system of white supremacy and the edict of Pope of Christianity, which authorized them to do this. So then the 14th Amendment says, all persons naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So they declared us to be citizens without giving us the rights of citizens. Thus, we still remain captives. Nobody asked us what did we want. The sine qua non of freedom is determination. And we were never given the opportunity to exercise self-determination as to what we wanted. We were just, by edict, made citizens in a land where we were still captives.
Right.
So I would say that we were still lawful captives based on the Constitution. And it was only with the coming of Master Father Muhammad that declared us a nation and gave us an option to exercise our independence on the basis of freedom, justice, and equality, and self-determination.
Yes, sir. That is beautiful. And you know what? Because I think what you're saying is right on point. And also, when we look at the fact that after the emancipation, after the federal troops were removed, then you get into this 1919, I mean, even before then, but I took it out of the book, How Whites Got So Rich. You know, you talk about the decimation of the Ku Klux Klan, where in 1919, thousands, 38 cities, American cities, where whites rioted and killed untold hundreds of blacks and destroying their property. You know, we know about the fact that we couldn't even do lawful wages because of they just wouldn't hire us. I mean, they don't even hire us today. So, you know, we got to look at how a person like our sister Tamika Drummer, how these communities got to the place that they are. And so magically, and I just want to throw that out there, I saw on some of these documentaries discussing the 14th Amendment, they go straight from slavery, and they talk about how the 14th Amendment denied us the right to stay at hotels or stay at stores and go into stores, but we didn't have anything. You know, and so that I think that's something we have to look at, the poverty, the lack of opportunity, the terrorism that existed that just really mowed our people down for another 100 years almost, you know, even until today. So this is where we are. And so everything you all have said has been so important because I wanted us to give our listeners an understanding of some of what we know about the law, the Constitution, and how we got to 2021, and we're still seeing the same thing. So if there are any questions or comments, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. If you all have any questions or comments, and because as you talked about, Brother Warren, we're this prey. And I think all of these cases, we look at Dante Wright, you know, we look at this vax. That is becoming the new norm. You know, you got signs in this final call, this week's final call, they talk about vaxxed only. You know, that looks like whites only, you know, the signs that we went through during, you know, segregation. And so all of these deprivations of rights, you know, you have so much police brutality. So, you know, let's talk about some of what we see in the courts, because I think it ties back into why all of you all are saying separation is really the only solution. So, you know, when we look at the devastation of the crime bill, when we look at, you know, right now we've got this case with Dante Wright. I don't know. Sister Saidiya does a lot of criminal trial work. Have you seen any of the footage on that where this white officer is saying that she made this colossal error in shooting this black man, this young black man? And if you have, do you have any comments on how that ties into just unjust injustice, unfair treatment?
So what we're seeing, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We're seeing the weaponization of the white woman against the black man.
Okay.
And this is something that is not uncommon. We've seen this time and time again, the white woman's fragility and how she uses it in order to hold the black man hostage and create a situation where they're, you know, when the law enforcement comes, they'll look at her, they'll look at him, and they see him as the aggressor. But nowadays, and I have to say this to the young people, they're pulling the cover off of this white woman weaponization. And exposing her and calling her as she is, that my young children, they talk about the Karens and the Kens. And because of social media, we're seeing this weaponization, you know, right in front of our face. And I don't think that they're buying her weaponization right now. She made a mistake. She's acknowledging it. So now she's hoping that she will get fair treatment and leniency because of her mistake that she made, killing the black man. And I see this all the time in, you know, the court systems that I work out at. You see a woman who calls the police on a black man in their neighborhood or call their license plate in. They're not doing anything. So the officer says that there's a reason to have a pretextual stop. And then they allege that they see contraband. And again, we see the prison, the pipeline system going on with the school system, the school policy with the zero tolerance in punishing these children for extremely minor infractions and putting them in jail when they could have resolved those issues through administration. And what we're seeing is 16% of those children, the black children in the school system, 16% of the children in the school systems are black. But you're seeing that 40% of those who are going to jail from the school systems are African American. So you have to ask the question, well, what is really going on? And we're dealing with implicit bias. We're seeing that in the police departments, implicit bias. We're seeing it in the school systems. And so this is something that is like an epidemic and a pandemic for black people, the implicit bias. And as much as we would like for them to get away from it, they're really exposing themselves, and we're seeing it live in modern time.
Yes, ma'am. I agree. Yep. Brother Warren, did you want to say anything about that? Because I had put out there just crying on the witness stand. When we saw Rittenhouse do it, I kind of let it go over my head. But this lady crying on the witness stand, I can't stand it.
Oh, they got a script. They have a script that they're working.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to say, concerning the crying on the witness stand, I haven't watched this particular case that you're talking about, but I did see, I guess it was Rittenhouse who's crying on the witness stand. But it's kind of like, who's doing the crying and who's doing the judging?
That's right.
Because when these white folk on the witness stand crying, if they're crying in front of their peers, well, then their peers are sympathetic or may have some empathy for them. Whereas, generally speaking, when I see them crying, it doesn't faze me at all. It's like water rolling off a duck's back. I could care less about them crying. But it reminds me of the O.J. Simpson trial, where there was a jury of black people, mostly black women. And I remember when the deceased sister was on the witness stand, Ms. Brown, and she just cried and cried and cried and cried. And all of the talking heads on TV were all so empathetic and sympathetic how she was crying and talking about how that was going to make such a dramatic impact on the jury. Well, that was a jury full of black women, and their verdict said they could care less about her crying. So it kind of depends on who's doing the crying and who they're crying to.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Did anyone else want to weigh in on that? Because, you know, I looked at it as well. Remember there was a time when there were, like, people were making up stories. Oh, a black man, he did this. And you know, everybody would believe, they'd make up false stories about the black man. Like Sister Sadia said, the weaponization of the white woman. You know, so now the new thing is, you know, she's crying and she's saying that it's some kind of colossal error. And it's like, well, how do you just kill somebody and it's a colossal error? It really reminds us of me of what the minister says, justifiable homicide. Because like you say, when our clients cry on the stand, there's no mercy. You know, the prosecutors use that to even dig in further. You know, oh, you up here crying, now you weren't crying when you was a monster. You know what I'm saying? That never, I just never see it work. So, you know, it's like a new scheme, like a poll tax. You know, this is the trick. You cry, you say that it's a mistake. Because I think the question, and Sister Idea, you and Judge Michelle, if you have any, you'd like to weigh in. Because why would you approach this young man as if he was a threat? You know, he was just a young man, and you know, she talks about how there was fear. But he was just, why? It was so routine. So that was something that I thought was noteworthy in that trial as well.
Jump in really quickly, Sister Pamela. You know, I, by way of background, when I was an attorney working for the city of Mount Vernon, which is a 3.6 square mile city with, you know, a mixture of folks, and I would say that black people are the predominant in our city, I represented the police department when they had cases. Now, when I represented the police department when they had cases, there was nothing like what we see across the country with people being shot in the back and some other things. But again, in this city, you have a black police commissioner, you got a black mayor, you got a black water department commissioner, you got, you know, so the officers are black and white and Latino, but everybody is well represented, let's just say that. And so when I did that, I was able to, and I did federal practice on this. It was 1983 action. Again, my defense of our police department was not cases like this. However, part of what I did for the city, I also trained the police department. So I was clear that annually we had to go into the police department to train on force and reiterating the skill set of de-escalation, because the job in and of itself keeps them at a certain level, black, white, and everything. And then you combine that with a white person that has no sophistication with regard to how to deal with black people or what our culture is, and it makes it worse and it makes them afraid. So we had to go in every year to debrief and go over it with the officers. So I'm clear that if you're not training on implicit bias, which, by the way, Sister Sadia and Sister Pamela and Brother Warren, in the court system here in New York, we're trained on implicit bias. We have a class in judges school that says, listen, you think you ain't biased, but you are. You got it implicitly, and we got to deal with that, because you can't have that as a judge, just like you can't have that as a police officer. And so there becomes this thing where you have to train and teach. But if nobody's interested in doing that, then it's not going to happen. And we're going to continue to see incidents where this happens, where things go wrong. But, you know, police officers work in what we call split-second decisions are made, and mistakes are made, right? They can be made, because the advent of the what's occurring is occurring very rapidly. So there's a very famous case that says you can't Monday morning quarterback fly on the federal level. They have grand protection, because these cases coming out of the Supreme Court, which I believe is Garner, protects them from, you know, second guessing the actions that are taken in this split second reaction that they have to do. And so I'm not making an excuse for this particular police officer, but there was a very famous case when tasers were first introduced where, you know, they didn't know the difference. And so they went to great extremes to put the taser on a different side, make it look differently, make it feel differently. And so what can she be liable of? Well, as a police officer, you're held to a higher standard. You can't make those mistakes. And if you meant to tase somebody, you got to remember that the left side is where your taser is, and it feels like this. You should be able to gauge that you're reaching for a firearm, and the taser feels different, because they went to great lengths to make sure that this didn't happen. Because when they first came out, this happened before. When somebody was killed, they meant to pull a taser, and they made a mistake and pulled the firearm. So they figured out how not to do that. But obviously, you know, she didn't have much interaction. I don't know if she had this kind of interaction before during her police career, but she made a mistake. So the problem is, was she negligent? Because she should have pulled from the right area that she was trained on. So, yes, ma'am. I mean, I come from a different perspective because I did defense work in this area. However, I'm clear that the fear that white officers have dictate sometimes their reaction and things that happen that are unequal and unfair, and how training is so important on implicit bias. And we do it in the judicial system, and they need to do it in the police system as well.
And you know, I think it's also possible that with hate crimes being on the rise in 2020. That's something that came out of CBS News, that there's been a 40% spike of hate crimes against black people, and that we're the most targeted, you know, that there may be some, there was some racial animus, because as Brother Abdul Arif raised last week when talking about Dred Scott and how we got from that decision that the intention to always keep racial, you know, racism in America, and the fact that black men are not respected, and that there is a genocidal plot. I mean, that's another part of possibility. So that just putting it out there, putting it out there. Yes, sir, Brother Warren.
No question.
I was just going to say, all of this speaks to the fact that the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us that separation is the best and only solution.
That's right.
Because in this, because we're like a man standing in front of a dam with a bunch of holes in it, and we keep trying to stick our, you know, finger in the hole, but there's just too many, there's more holes than we have fingers. You know, and trying to get justice in the courts and under the Constitution and all of it, it's all rigged up, because it was as Minister Farrakhan described, the architecture of white supremacy. Well, the architect lays the blueprint that the house is built on.
That's right.
So the architecture of white supremacy has defined what this system is. And it cannot and it will not ever provide freedom, justice, and equality to us. And that's why the Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that the best and only solution is separation.
Beautiful.
Yes, sir.
You know, because another article that was in the final call, it's called We've Had Enough. And this article was about black female cops who sued the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. And I thought that case was very interesting because it talked about how the misconduct of white officers that were accused of misconduct, and these black women were actually retaliated against is what they're alleging, because they would actually try to, you know, be fair, like you're saying, Sister Nichelle, and make sure that officers were investigated. So this particular officer, an officer with a body cam, and a 19-year-old, and the officer was caught lying about what he was doing, because he was actually grabbing the child. You know, you could see it on the body cam. But then the officer, according to this article, he was claiming that the child was resisting arrest. You know, first he said he assaulted the police, but then he got a resisting arrest charge. But then it was on the body cam, and so it told a different story. And the black woman who was investigating it, the police officer, she ended up, kind of getting removed, I think, and they're suing. So, you know, it's really, as Brother Warren said, there's some institutionalized racism that we're looking going way, way back. But it's a beautiful conversation. So, again, if we have any questions or comments for these attorneys, please don't hesitate to press the number one to get into the host queue. Because I think also when you look at the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, there was an article there that talked about some of the evidence that got withheld. Like there was, I think, a video cam or something of him punching a woman from the back. I think there was another video that he is alleged to have been saying he wished he could shoot people or something. Some people with hoodies coming out of a CVS. And in that article, they talked about how judges in criminal trials tightly control what juries do and don't hear. And they, you know, get to say it's misleading or it's confusing, and it doesn't get before the juries, as we know. But isn't it, I think when it comes to black defendants, you know, do we feel, anybody on the panel feel like the unfairness or the injustice with how sometimes they're tried, our brothers and sisters? I mean, look at this woman, this sister with a life sentence for less than 4 ounces of marijuana. I mean, where do we do that in a civilized nation? So So, you know, do we see any more personal experiences that we see this type of injustice in the court to just kind of buttress some of our arguments here?
Let me say this. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Sister Sadia. Yes, ma'am.
No, I'm just going to talk about my personal experience going to a county here in Texas, white Republican, but you swear, you know, we're still living in the Jim Crow era when you go into that town, the mentality. And one gentleman for a drug possession, you know, received 80 years in prison. And when I started talking to the people in the county, it was a very common thing for individuals that may have some prior criminal history. Of course, the sister drummer, she has some prior criminal history. But, you know, as soon as he picks up a minor drug offense, instead of getting the drug treatment, because most of this is when people are taking drugs, you're having an underlying mental health issue. And the way that I handle cases, I always, you know, go to the mental health of my client. Why are you medicating and using drugs and trying to get the courts to see that we have to treat the whole person? And so, you know, it depends on the county. It depends on the judges that you have in front of you. We are blessed in Harris County that we have, you know, we're that county that had the 19 black women. So we're more empathetic when it comes to handling people who have mental health issues or issues, period. You know, we do believe in mercy and grace, and not this hardline conservative lock them up, put them in jail, and no hope for a person. But we have to treat the whole person. And so as an attorney, that's my attempt, is to force the judges to look at my client as a person and treat the whole person.
Yes, ma'am, what I was going to say, that's beautiful, Sister Sadia. Yes, ma'am. That's where you are there with those powerful black judges. I saw that in the media, all those sisters that got on that bench. But all praise is due to Allah. But yes, ma'am. So to me, Sister Pamela, and to the audience, the fact that we have to have implicit bias training tells us mm-hmm. that there is implicit bias. And so when judges are making decisions, they're biased. And I see it all the time. And here in New York, the legislature did something, and the legislature is filled with a lot of our people, and they are strong. And they came out with this no bail and the bail reform and some other things, even landlord tenant, which went across the board. And some of the judges, including, you know, black judges, were like, man, that took some discretion away from us as judges. Man, y'all went eight crazy on this. Y'all didn't have to go so hard. But they said we had to because, see, y'all are good down there. But up county, where some of the other judges are white, they're not doing like you guys down here. They are, and so we have to spank them a little bit and say, okay, guess what? No bail for any of these crimes. As soon as they come in, ROR, you know, because, you know, and that wasn't, you know, so they made it clear that this is not really, it's for those judges up there that can't get past their implicit bias and their white supremacist attitude or bringing into the courtroom what they think and see in the movies and everything and then judging accordingly. And so, you know, like Sister Sadia said, it depends on where you are. You got these people out there, which is why, you know, I'm a judge, and one of the reasons why I stay here is because I know that it's so important to unravel or try to. Now, we know we're waiting along. We said it last week. How long are we going to wait? Separation is definitely the answer. Let me be clear. But while we're not separated, we're going to do what we got to do within the structure we got and try to at least make an impact before the exodus per se. So, you know, as a judge here, we're very mindful. In this court that I'm in, there are two other black judges. One white judge is retiring in December, and I think his replacement is probably going to be a black judge, which will have the first all-black courtroom, I think, here in Westchester County. And with that said, we're very progressive thinking individuals, freedom fighters and everything else. And so if we see a injustice, we correct it. Now, even though I came from a background of defending police officers in my courtroom where I see they haven't done the right thing, I have no problem saying that's it. It's dismissed or, you know, felony, because I'm going to do what's right. Now, you know, if this person, you want to get them on another day, but the bottom line is you're not going to be illegal and do it in my court. So if the search was bad, I'm going to say it's bad. you know, and so that's the beauty of being black and being on the bench and having the power, at least in this world for right now, for what it's worth. All praise is due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Praise be to Allah. Because as you said, with the tears, you know, because I've seen, especially practicing early in the early 90s when a lot of the crime legislation was in place and the juveniles were being incarcerated, there were a lot of tears. I mean, we know the Central Park Five. There were so many tears when we watched that Ava DuVernay documentary. And, you know, when you do have black faces, I think you do have a better compassion. Because, again, the people are saying, you can be a part of my community, and I want you to make it. And so those are some of the blueprints for building our own communities and making our own communities decent and safe places to live.
That's right.
I agree with you all on that. So, you know, again, and this will be our last conversation for our segments on the Constitution and the laws and the history. But, so many people are like Brother Warren, I think, may have brought out, you know, or maybe it was you, Sister Idea, but this point that somehow the federal government is going to be able to solve our problems. And I think this hope that's being pushed, you know, I think it's really important that people understand. So now this is your history. So there's this issue about how whites act in alignment with one another, and that is something that was always part of the framework, of the 13th Amendment issue, where you say that if they're going to practice this implicit bias, you know, there's some what they call group status protection where like, for example, with Ahmaud Arbery, we saw the prosecutor who was actually now charged with a crime. She, you know, tried to act in alignment with one of the former officers in actually maybe, trying to cover up that murder or cover up that racism or, you know, something as simple as a friend of mine was telling me he was in a small town like you were in, Sister Sadia, and he wanted a warrant recall for his client. And the prosecutor said, well, okay, she's a white girl. She said, you know, I don't have an objection to it. But the judge was kind of like, what? You know, you're doing different than me. And so then the prosecutor, she jumped in line because there's this thing that we're seeing in the law where, you know, do we think sometimes white people do stand in alignment with each other when it comes to opposing and being racial discriminatory toward black people? And is that part of the problem? You know, to me, sometimes it reminds me of mobs. You know, when they talk about the mobs that used to go on, or like the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would say that maybe they took off their white robes and put on their police uniforms or, you know, judge uniforms. So what about this group status protection? Because, again, I'm trying to get people to understand that we still have some of the same legacy of slavery and, like you said, Brother Warren, with the deprivation of rights that's being practiced today. Anyone have a comment?
Yes, ma'am. So what we saw in the Trump era is we saw the poor whites coming to the forefront and the lights being shined upon them. And so we know that during slavery, the politicians pitted the poor slave masters against the slaves. But we know that they were not in a better predicament than the slaves were. If we look at welfare and who is on welfare, you know that the white man or the white woman is one of the biggest recipients of welfare. If you look at this whole vax mandate that we see the infighting, right, of the poor saying they don't want the government in control over them and their body, especially in the state of Texas. So now what we have is the upper establishment or the elite establishment controlling everything. We call them the 10%, right?
Okay.
And we are what you consider the poor righteous teachers, the black man, the black woman, and then you got our 85% who just don't know who they are. So But because the light is being shown on them and we see who the enemy truly is, and our children nowadays are not the same people that, you know, that you can bamboozle back in the 60 eras or even in the 70s. They're fearless, and their mind is more open. And, you know, even I hear my children talk about slavery and racism. That's all they talk about. They hear something, everything is anti-racism for them. It could not even be about race, but they're very sensitive to it. And so right now, looking at history and its unfoldment, it's the greatest time for the black man and the black woman to be who we truly are. You know, I looked at the New York Police Department and the sister, the commissioner. Did y'all see that last week?
Mm-hmm.
They just appointed a sister as the commissioner of the New York Police Department. Not that it's the answer, because, of course, separation is the key, but it's a sign for us to see what is happening as well.
Okay. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
That's beautiful.
That's right.
Anybody else?
Agree.
Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. I can't say the court system in particular, but I do find that, you know, white people will stick together in very subtle ways, especially. So I used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and I worked in a section that had a lot of black workers in it. There was a white man who joined the force, and he might have been the only white guy or maybe two white people in amongst the sea of black people working in this particular area at the bank. And one of the things that happened is that the workers would go out and train different banks on how to process money. And so one of the vice presidents, and I didn't know how this particular white guy got all of the promotions and stuff, but another white person said to me, let me tell you what happened. One of the vice presidents, white, told him when he first got there. Now, he's new. These other black folks have been here doing money and mastering their skill set and just as good or better. And but he said to him, when you guys go out to present, make sure you get the person to write a recommendation letter on how well you did. So every place where the white person went to do what everybody was doing, but they were not advised by anyone to get a letter at the end of it from the person that you were teaching the business, he would come back with letters because the white man told him this is what you need to do. So when it came time to say, oh, who gets a promotion or who did well? Well, Tom's got 15 letters from the 15 places he visited saying how fabulous he was. But that was because a white vice president told them to get it. But nobody told the black brothers and sisters, when you go, if somebody liked what you did, get them to get you a letter to put into your folder. This is how you get your folder up. And then when promotions come, they're looking at, you know, 10 letters you got. But they told him.
Right.
And I said, man, you see, so it may not be in your face, but it's subtle ways that they stick together to elevate each other, and we have no idea. And he would always get the promotions. And I said, well, and then another white guy said, oh, man, he gets letters in his folder. He was told what to do. I think it does happen, Sister Pamela, absolutely. They fall in line with one another, especially if you're afraid that the black people will rise and then do what you did to them, which is what the thinking is for some white people, is that black people are going to get to the point where they're going to be in control, and then they're going to do to us what we did to them. That would never happen. But, you know, so the fear is there, so they do stick together, absolutely.
Yeah.
But they know their time is up. That's why they're fighting hard.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. And I think it puts out the thought that we need to stick together as well, because this is what civilized people do. I mean, again, when we look at the Torchlight for America, again, in the greed and leadership state of mind, because a lot of this is about greed and money and corporate control, which slavery came out of. And the minister talks about there is a genocidal plan against black people. The desire of many of those in power is the maintenance of white supremacy. Whites and their institutions have created inferior-minded black people with a slave mentality. There are those who do not wish to see us equals in society. So a generation after generation of black people have been corrupted with a slave mentality, and generation after generation of white people have been poisoned with the doctrine of white supremacy. So I think when we look at those of us who aren't putting the race issue out front and the need for black people to build first and foremost as black people, and, you know, a lot of this diversity is not, you know, diversity says let's all get along, you know, when our conditions and our communities are still in need of us coming together. I think we have to look at that, especially, and we're kind of getting there. We're almost done, but we do want to talk about the vaccine, and we do want to talk about the fact that the laws that many of our people are actually pushing, you know, and you know, that's a problem. We believe, I saw the doctor who is an expert with a PhD, she said that, you know, you're a slave if someone forces you to do something against your will. And she's talking about those of us who don't want to take that shot. And so is that depriving us of rights, the 13th Amendment, you know, forcing these jabs? What about the censorship that we've seen? I mean, we've never lived in a time when, you know, you can't talk about certain things. You're not getting news coverage. So, you know, as we're looking at this, we're not going backwards. Like Brother Warren said, we, you know, God came, and after that we're going to go into our own nation, you know, with substance. But where we're at right now, we're seeing a lot of targeting, you know, depopulation agenda. So is there any comments that we want to talk about with any of this, the vaccine, the you know, the new norms, the mandates, forcing these jabs? You know, we as attorneys, you know, where we're used to laws that give people rights, Bill of Rights, freedom of religion, those type of things.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I'll take this one really quickly because, you know, New York is a major state who's hard body on this vaccination and coming out with most of the, everybody's got to be vaccinated, can't get into the place, can't do this, can't do that. It's a strong state for this vaccine. And I think it's terrible, of course. You know, a lot of the believers here have submitted for religious exemptions. I know I did. And I thank Allah that my exemption was granted, but we had to fight hard for it, you know. And I think it's terrible what's happening. And New York is kind of like leading the states with regard to its very progressive or rigid nation, or you can't do this and you can't do that. And but here in New York, we've done a pretty good job of securing religious exemptions for right now. I'm thinking, you know, the sisters and brothers that work for the New York State Board of Education in the city have gotten religious exemptions. I know I got a religious exemption. A few believers have gotten religious exemption across private institutions. I'm not saying that some people have not lost their job. They have. But I can't say it's on a grand scale level, despite the fact that New York is a hard vaccination state. We've been able to get through with exemptions. And we've used, of course, the language that the Nation of Islam is a you know, religious organization organized since the 1930s, sincerely held religious belief is anti-vaccine from the beginning. We've always been granted religious exemptions here in the state of New York and everywhere, I imagine, but definitely here in the state of New York. And so that's kind of like followed the logic that we believe we should have it now. And for the most part, we've been successful in that. But I think it's a terrible thing to mandate people. I agree. It's controlling your body back to slavery. We're going to tell you what you're going to put in your body and tell you how you, it's almost like when they used to force the medicine or force the food down the slave's throat. You know what I'm saying? As a way of control.
Ma'am.
And it's unfortunate because a lot of our brothers and sisters, like, for instance, I'm a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, and they're even so hard on it that they won't even allow us to participate. And a lot of the sisters in the nation that are also AKAs, we've been really, you know, trying to figure out, do we give them a letter? Do we argue with them? Because they've been very clear that you can't participate if you're not vaccinated. And but again, you have to balance that with this whole thing about separation. Maybe, you know, it's part time to separate, and we're not meant to try to fight to get anywhere, you know, or fight to be included. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
well,
ma'am.
I agree with everything you're saying, sis. And then the thing is, you know, with these mandates, it's tied to economics, right? So you always have to look at the money and the finances. So if you take away a person's ability to survive, their economics to survive, then they're going to, you know, they know that this vaccine may not be the best thing for me and my family. But because they are, you know, subjected to fear and the ability to survive, then they succumb to the system. And the system knows this. This is a mentality. Again, separation is the only key. We have to create economics for ourselves so that we won't be tied to the system. And I think in the Nation of Islam, I know in the Nation of Islam, if we continue to hear the word and obey and do for self, and your blessed sister Nichelle, my husband, he actually works for NASA, and so he submitted his documents and. Of course, with the religious exemption and the medical exemption, because he gave them the actual science of why he was not going to take the vaccine. And they accepted it. But I know that Biden today, I believe, or was it yesterday, he's because of Omicron, if you haven't noticed, you know, the propaganda has doubled up now more than it was with Delta. And so they keep changing the goalposts as it concerns the mandate for these vaccines and how you can move around. So they're saying, no, we're not taking your constitutional right. We're not going to force you to take it. But technically they are forcing us to take it.
Yeah, no question. Like you say, so then the separation does become the solution, because as our minister told us, we will not take it. And, you know, we're talking about something that's not been proven safe or effective. There are scientists, Dr. Peter McCullough, he said it's dangerous and ineffective. And, you know, one of the things we were trying to get across with our show today, when we talk about our history, when we talk about this white supremacist mind that, you know, the depopulation briefs in the final call talk about, you know, the minister says we have no right to trust white people on this vaccine. And so we just have no rights. You know, Sister Sadia, you brought up the corporations and the greed we have in the final call, you know, today, how all these sponsors, these big pharma sponsors in mainstream media, and we know that they support Congress, they give money, you know, they run many areas of the law, and this is money control. They're making all this money giving these shots, you know, but here we are again, just as during the Emancipation Proclamation, being treated like we these childlike people who are told what to think, told what to feel. And, you know, so I just thank Allah for the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and Master Farah Muhammad for coming and raising one up and teaching us and, you know, making us free or on our way to freedom, full and complete freedom. So, you know, as attorneys, this is a very interesting time in the law.
Absolutely. There's a lot of precedent happening right now as concerning these vaccine mandates.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Very interesting. Brother Warren, are you there? Because I know Brother Warren came on the show that we did about medical malpractice and, you know, not even getting into the safety and the efficacy of this shot.
And
how so. Ma'am, yeah, can't even sue anybody. No liability. You know, this is just outrageous. So I don't know if we're down to the last 5 minutes. We can begin to close out. If Brother Warren had a remark he wanted to make, I surely welcome it. Appreciate you.
Yes, ma'am. I'm still here. I was just really in of common mind in accord with Sister Nichelle and Sister Sadia have been saying. And we just have to, I like what Sister Nichelle said when separation is our ultimate goal and the ultimate solution. In the meantime, we have to fight, and Sister Sadia said the same thing, we have to fight for what we can get and fight hard to get what justice that we can. It's not a perfect situation for us, but we have to be vigilant and militant and on our on guard and on our post at all times to protect what rights we have, what opportunities we have. And for those who have had enough, I invite you to explore and study the teaching of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And it's not a quote-unquote Muslim-only thing. That was recently a meeting of the Nubian Leadership Circle, which is trying to organize our people for separation and independence. And there are many registered Muslims in the group, but all are not. And the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan gave the keynote address. He's telling us we're a nation. We're not
That's
just
right.
a religion or a group of religious bodies. We are a nation. And if anything, this study of the Constitution will tell you is that, as Patrick Moynihan said many years ago, there are two Americas, one black and one white, and they're not equal.
Mm.
And we're not the white one. So we have to view ourselves as a nation. Don't get too caught up in the fact that we have been given citizenship and all of these constitutional rights. We are a nation. We need to begin to think and act like we are.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you. So anyone else want to make a closing remark? I thank you all so much for coming on the show. I think the need to really talk about some of this academic conversation is just important. Inshallah, we've been able to give some information to the listeners. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. So, Sister
thank
Michelle.
You. Thank you, Sister Pam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. Sister Sadia, yes, thank
I just
you.
Wanted to say, thank you so much for just having a platform like this. Like you said, that the intelligent dialogue, discord that we're having, you know, just to make us not be just surface dwellers and accept what comes our way. So I thank you for allowing us to be on here, having great minds like Brother Warren, yourself, Sister Michelle, to come and speak. But I just wanted to say thank you and all praise due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. All praises are due to Allah. Thank you, Sister Sadia. And so, Judge Nichelle,
yes.
We appreciate you coming on. And I know as this year is winding down, you worked so hard. So thank you once again for being a panelist. Beautiful sister.
Absolutely. Love
beautiful.
To be here, sister. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I could say it's a beautiful platform because for those who may think that the educated Negroes don't understand or don't submit to the will of God, and we know the best study is the teachings that we got from the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, bar none, no matter what degrees we have, juris doctorate, what else. We're clear that the real information and the real education comes from this black man, and
that's
so
right.
As educated as we may be, whatever degrees we have, we submit to do the will of Allah, and we're clear that no study is better than the study that we have being members of the Nation of Islam and having the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad given to us. So we're clear,
that's
and it's
beautiful.
Good to have a platform where they hear it. Where you say, yeah, you
yes,
got these high-falutin roles, or so they think they are, but no, we're not. We're clear that we get these degrees, but we know what the main one is. And so I'm happy to share this platform with my brothers and sisters to see that we're of like mind, like heart, and all praise is due to Allah. And I thank you, Sister Pamela, for being one of those people as well, Sister, an attorney by trade, but a believer by your substance and your life, Sister. So all praise
yes,
is due to Allah.
All praises are due to Allah. So thank you all for listening to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. I want to remind the sisters that Sister Minister Ava We have to thank her for the Elevated Places Network, and I want to remind you all to listen to her show on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. She has a Sisters Only Master's class on December the 27th. That's Monday. There's still time to register. I want to thank my executive producer, my producer, Sister Samaya, and I want to thank the Elevated Places team. Thank you to all of the listeners, and thank you to our special guests tonight, Brother Attorney Warren Muhammad, Attorney Sadia Kareem, and Judge Michelle Muhammad. Thank you all. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum salam.
Bless you.